Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Danner Boots. Modern construction meets legendary Danner quality and durability with the Stronghold Work Boot. Born from logging and exploration, Danner is a Pacific Northwest original. Every boot is handmade to hold up in unforgiving conditions and live up to our unyielding standards. The Stronghold Work Boot is what happens when more than 85 years of legendary quality, durability, and heritage run into modern construction, technology, and materials. Tomorrow's classic is available today, the Stronghold Work Boot. You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And today, Neil, I wanted to kind of get a level set on a big topic that's been kind of floating around, and it's only going to come into clearer view in the next couple of months, the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR. And now every time anybody says GDPR, I think the German Democratic People's Republic is coming back. Do we need David Hasselhoff again? But that's not what it is. We're talking about exporting of people's data outside of the EU and protections and thinking around that. And this is really one of the first pieces of legislation that is trying to tackle this huge nebulous thing in any sort of a formal way. So give us a sort of a lowdown. How do you see its impacts?
So I guess it's not so much new legislation as I understand it. Its reformation is old, and I'm certainly not an expert on it. I have read it once. I've been in lots of debates on it where you sort of ask, people talk about it a lot, and then you say, so who has actually read it?
And and you have actually spent the time to read the thing.
I have spent the time, but it was a while ago. And I don't know, I think, okay, so there's a history to these things. Actually, I've got this book in my hand because you mentioned that this was going to come up. That's called The Assault on Privacy. It's by a guy called Arthur Miller. And it's got a great quote from Ralph Nader on it. A lucid presentation of what misuse of computers is doing and can do to individual freedoms by the possession and distribution of personal information for manipulative purposes. The author warns of a new form of human slavery in an age when the computer is emerging from its infancy.
That's Ralph Nader.
That's Ralph Nader quoted talking about Arthur Miller. The other thing about this, so you might get a little bit of a hint about the era from this book when I read quotes that are on the back. Today's laser technology already makes it feasible to store a 20-page dossier on every American on a piece of tape that is less than 5,000 feet long.
20 pages on every American? My God.
Less than 5,000 feet of tape.
That's insane.
Information handling on a computerized basis is a low visibility operation. An individual may never discover that he is the subject of a file or be given any precise knowledge of what is in it. I mean, it's filled with wonderful things like that. And, of course, the book is published. Let's see. I'll just flick through.
It's 1984.
No, it's second printing 71. I've got it in hardcover.
Wow.
A friend gave it to me. If you read it, the genesis of the book can be traced from fall 1966. Arthur Miller, I think he was in his, I'm thinking his 40s. He's like still around now. He was ended up as a professor at Harvard. That goes back to, actually, a lot of the origin of this legislation is much older than people are sort of realizing. Certainly in the European legislation, I think it's in the early 80s, the first. And the term data protection is a kind of, I think, as I probably said on this program before, a horrible term. It's so the first act was, I think, something along the lines of, the term was more like protection of individuals with respect to their personal private data or something like that. And that's early 80s. The GDPR actually goes to, I think, 1998 it was first drafted.
It's reforming the Data Protection Directive from 1995.
Yeah. And it's more about a sort of universal implementation, which is quite hard to do in European law, I think. It is my understanding. I'm not an expert. But just from talking to other people, that it takes a while to get something to apply universally. I think one of the big changes is the fines are proportional to revenue.
Yeah.
Worldwide revenue, I think, is something like that, which is a significant in terms of enforcement. But I do think, and it's interesting when you hear people talk about it, Certainly, there's a lot of different interpretations. So there's things like the right to an explanation, but the terminology around it, if there's a significant effect on you on the decision, and what an explanation is, all these sort of things, I think, are going to take some time to shake out. And there's actually, we just had Sandra Vokta speak in my group, who's written very interestingly on this area in terms of what explanation means. And she's been looking at counterfactuals as a way of driving that. I think there's interesting work in that, but it's been driving, I think, as well, a lot of the work in machine learning in this space around, I mean, what fairness is. I mean, there are protected categories you can't discriminate against. I'm trying to remember them all. There's religion, race, medical grounds, sexuality, I think. Set gender as well. I'm not sure that those are that's an exhaustive list. But, you know, so you've got to be able to demonstrate your algorithms are fair in that sense. I think that the interesting thing I find about it is when I read all these things from the perspective of someone who creates algorithms, I just think, well, this is all stuff that I would actually really want to be able to show about my systems. And when it comes in from the outside as regulation, it feels like, oh, regulation, they're imposing stuff. But when if it comes from inside you as a sort of like, oh, wouldn't it be good if I could explain why certain decisions are being made, like, it seems like a reasonable request. And, you know, also if something, certainly when you're focused on the people you're trying to help, your customers or patients or whatever else, it seems really, really important. So, you know, the thing I tend to say about it is that, you know, we should be thinking about this stuff anyway.
So we should think of it as like good darn programming reminders.
No, I like it as, I call it good data practice rules.
Oh, that's great. That's even better.
Yeah. So whenever I think of GDPR, I just say good data practice rules, because the mention of data protection is already, it's like, oh, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Like, is data becoming extinct, or, you know, it sounds wrong. So good data
a
practice
little wildlife
rules.
Refuge for data.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we'll see how it pans out. And, you know, I think that there's how people will address enforcement and these things, because up until now, as far as I've understood, this is just the Information Commissioner's Office.
Yes.
And we saw them, for example, in jackets entering Cambridge Analytica's offices fairly recently, which I thought was very American, very FBI. They had these ICO jackets on. And I'd never seen that before. And I don't think they've been, you know, in the past, I don't think they're funded to a massive extent. I don't think that they've been empowered to do large-scale investigations. So I suspect we'll see a lot of movement in that space in terms of how that's going to be done. And there'll be localized interpretations as well.
Yeah. We're coming up on the implementation date, which is May 25th of this year. So we'll see what actually changes after this 2-year transition period since its introduction.
And I think we'll start seeing things about, there'll be precedent set. Because actually, I've been in rooms with lawyers and they don't even seem to agree on the interpretations
right
as they'll be laid out. So I think that's their job, to disagree with each other. So I don't know if that's... I think it's kind of like, you know, if you ask like a room full of machine learners about some particular technical point to do with classification, they'll make it sound way more complicated than they should, just because they're very... Maybe. There would be that effect, right?
Right.
You know, get a room full of 5 machine learners and ask them about a neural network, and they'll just say... not even a neural, that's more complicated. You know, like a logistic regression, they'll probably... say 25 yes. different things. Yeah,
totally. We'll have much more about the good data practice rules coming up on the show up until the implementation date of the 25th, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about it then.
And we'll provide a link to the actual rules that are online.
We will provide a link to the actual rules so that you, too, listener, can be the only person appearing on a panel who has actually read the rules. Amazing stuff.
I read them. I don't remember what they said, but I did read them.
I did read them. That's the point. You'll find all that on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. So, Neil, this week's listener question on Talking Machines comes to us via Twitter. And if you've got one for Talking Machines, you can send it over to us at TLKNGMCHNS. I know Ryan still wants me to change that Twitter handle, but no, I stand firm. So can you talk about approximate inference, especially MCMC versus VI, and when they work and when they fail, the successes of VI for training probabilistic neural networks, especially VAEs, and seeming lack of MCMC in neural networks is interesting. And the writer says, I study MCMC-like dynamics in real brains. So let's talk about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And as someone who's mainly worked in variational methods, I've thought about it a fair amount. So why are we interested in doing approximate inference? Well, you know, the probabilistic modeling or the Bayesian paradigm says, well, we can build complex probabilistic models, and then we don't have to worry about the decisions. We just sort of build a joint probability distribution over everything we're interested in, and then we can interrogate it. Sort of what's the probability of the temperature tomorrow given mm-hmm. I don't know, the temperature yesterday or questions like that. But to do so involves integrating out variables in the system. And variational inference and MCMC are two different techniques. So I think MCMC goes back to the Metropolis algorithm, I think. A paper by Metropolis Hastings we talk about. And I think that my understanding is that it was actually likely used in the Manhattan Project for integrals that were important in nuclear weapons. So physicists were very familiar with it. And that involves approximating the integral over a probability distribution with the discrete sum under samples under that probability distribution. And MCMC is an approach to obtaining those samples through driving a Markov chain to its stationary distribution, where the stationary distribution matches the distribution you have of interest. Mm-hmm. And it gives you mechanisms to do that, one which is, I think, a sufficient but not necessary condition of detailed balance. So there's sort of, and it's related, there's you know, lots of related algorithms like simulated annealing, which are used for optimization. So I think for myself, aesthetically, I sort of went for variational methods as my approximation of choice. The reason being is that I guess my brain wasn't big enough to be expert in both the domains, and I had to choose one. And also, I happened even back as far back as my PhD thesis, I was introduced to these things, and I just thought the math was very cool. So variational methods are an alternative approach where you try and replace the integral that you're interested in with an optimization. And a particular route we use for that is something known as Jensen's inequality. So the trick there is to lower bound an integral that is difficult with a integral that is more tractable. And then the bound itself can typically be tightened by moving parameters. Okay, so that's broad. I haven't really said much about why one would choose one or the other, apart from you just might choose one if your brain wasn't big enough to understand in depth both areas. But I'd say, so I remember having a discussion about this long time ago with Mark Girolami, when we were both working in systems biology, and he was doing a lot of MCMC and I was doing a lot of variational. And I think the gist of the conversation was, you know, I like variational because the fact that you've got this optimization means that it's easy to see when you're converging, and you end up as a side effect of your algorithm, often with these lower bounds that reflect something about the true likelihood, and you can jointly optimize your lower bound with respect to parameters of the model and parameters that you're not integrating over and the things you're integrating over. I kind of like those things. I think the challenge is that you typically are quite constrained in the form of your approximation. So the way you make it tractable is you make assumptions about the posterior distribution, often independence assumptions. But also you make an assumption about perhaps the a parametric family of distributions that you say your posterior is. So in work I do with latent variable models, we make a parametric assumption that the posterior is Gaussian when it's not. And that also happens a lot in the more recent work on neural networks, which are actually very similar to that we were doing with Gaussian processes. And actually I worked on in my thesis as well, the variational approximations. That's quite a long time ago, 20 years ago. I didn't do variational autoencoders. I think that the reason why variational is dominant in neural networks is, well, particularly with the autoencoder, that's a way of, in effect, reducing the number of variational parameters you need, and that allows you to do very, very large data. Mm. I think one challenge when you're doing large data, if you've got latent variables you're interested in with MCMC, is you have to do samples over many, many, like if you've got 17 million data and you're doing a variational sort of dimensionality reduction algorithm or sort of an unsupervised learning algorithm where you've got latent variables, the sampling over those latent variables, you need there's many latent variables because there's one for each data point. So the 17 million data, you now got 17 million latent variables. And you don't want one sample at each. So you can sort of see that there's some issues one needs to deal with. The same thing happens in variational, but the way they deal with that is they parameterize the variational distributions from sort of neural networks. And that seems to be being quite effective. The nice thing about MCMC is that you can, if you go with it for long enough, you're sort of guaranteed to converge to the right answer, an unbiased estimate of the things you're interested in. And that isn't true for these variational things. And so I think that's what Mark would have said in the systems biology days, and certainly we worked on these sort of things together, is that if you really believe in the model you've written down and you're not interested in like its predictive output, you're actually interested in really trying to find out if the model you've written down is the correct one for the data, then MCMC seems to be better, because otherwise you can't disentangle, you know, you just run it for a really, really, really long time. There was less data than we're sort of talking about for these deep neural networks. But I would say that the first most successful of these two, I mean, there's also the Laplace approximation, which David Mackay did, approaches to neural networks, was actually a Radford Neil with, I think at the time it was hybrid Monte Carlo, or now it'd be Hamiltonian Monte Carlo approaches. And they are really effective. Like, the thing I found that in my own PhD thesis, I was comparing this variational approach I had to neural networks, which I was quite pleased with. In fact, I was doing mixtures of variational distributions. And I made the mistake of comparing him to Radford Neil's out-of-the-box code.
Oh, no.
And it just blew my stuff away. And I never got the thing published, because everyone's like, well, you've done all this work on these. I was young and naive, and actually tried to show all the, which I still try to do today. But all the authors, all the reviewers didn't like the fact that, I was being outperformed by Radford Neil's code. But that I'd be curious for people to do a sort of real study using those techniques against the variational approximations in just a one-layer neural network. Because my own feeling is that the variational approximations, certainly back in the day when I did it in my thesis, had severe problems in modeling the correlation between weights, and that's often what gives you the interesting uncertainty structure. And that's actually why I moved to Gaussian processes sort of whatever 17 years ago, because that correlation structure was really, really difficult to capture in the variational approximations. You could capture it in hybrid Monte Carlo, but again, that sampling, and you need to use, you know, for very large systems, I don't think people are using Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, so I should say. So I guess part of the answer is horses for courses. If you really, really believe in your probabilistic model, you should be going for HMC or Markov chain Monte Carlo of some form. But there's another thing, another twist in that story that I think is very, very interesting, was work by Max Welling and Uyte and others, where they look at, and I think this is the way we should be doing everything. I love this work. The premise of the work, and there's a series of papers according to this premise, is that when we're looking at Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, we're typically trying to prove unbiasedness in the limit as we take a large number of samples, which does sound very nice. But actually, when you design algorithms that do that, they do so at the sort of bias variance dilemmas. They tend to do so at the expense of variance early on in the sampling. So you've got proof that after many samples, you're unbiased, but that sacrifice is like early on in your sampling that any estimates you make of any expectations of interest have high variance error. And if you sort of say, well, actually, I know I'm compute bounded, so I'm never going to get to this point of unbiasedness anyway, and I'd just like to get close to the answer quicker, then you can start looking at different classes of MCMC algorithms. And I think that it's reasonably controversial in the stats community, but I think it's really cool and absolutely the right approach. I think we should always be trading. It's the right way of thinking. I mean, whether it's the right approach, it's contextual, but it's a great way of thinking. I think we should always be trying to trade off the amount of computation we're prepared to do against the quality of the answer. If you look in real world problems, that trade-off is always there. And so I think that that's, I mean, it's interesting, it's Max Welling that also was one of the people involved in variational autoencoders. So, I mean, Max's body of work in this area is really impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
So we should ask Max, not me. Not my conclusion. Let's get Max on the show and ask him.
Well, we'll get an answer. We'll get a straight answer from Max Welling. If you've got a question for Talking Machines, you can email us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com or tweet us at TLKNGMCHNS.
Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Backblaze. Backblaze offers unlimited cloud backup for Macs and PCs for just $5 a month. With over 500 petabytes of data under management, you can use it to back up documents, music, photos, videos, drawings, projects, anything. Access your data from anywhere in the world, on the web or on the go on your phone. And best of all, you can restore just one file or all your files. The choice is yours. Plus, if you have a complete system failure, you can purchase a hard drive with all your data on it, overnighted via FedEx. You can even return the drive and get a full refund. It's a win-win. And opt for business backup and get the same great Backblaze service with administrative tools using Backblaze Groups. Over 28 billion files have been restored. That's a lot of returned documents and memories. Make sure you visit backblaze.com/machines so they know where you came from and they can continue to support the show. You'll receive a fully featured 15-day free trial. Just go to backblaze.com/machines. Play with it and start protecting yourself from potential bad times. That's backblaze.com/machines.
This week's guest on Talking Machines is Andrew Blake. He's research director at the Alan Turing Institute. And we got a chance to sit down with him when he was at the event that we visited a couple of weeks ago at the American Academy that was also put on by the Royal Society. And the first question we asked him, like we ask everybody all the time, is how did you get where you are?
Professor Blake, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us on Talking Machines.
You can call me Andrew.
Okay, right, fantastic. All right, Andrew.
Yes.
We asked everyone the same question first when they come and sit down for an interview. How did you get where you are? What's been your academic journey?
Oh, well, it's been quite a complicated journey, and it wasn't all academic. So let's think about this. I started out as a mathematician, studying mathematics as an undergraduate, and then I kind of got this idea that I'd had enough of what seemed like man-made things. I wanted to look at sort of, you know, real physical things. So I switched to engineering and finished off my degree in engineering, and I worked on lasers. I made my own carbon dioxide laser. It was very exciting.
Very nice.
And I spent many afternoons in the lab trying to get this thing to work. And, and then I went to MIT for a year, just down the road from where we are now. And that was a bit of an accident. I applied for a scholarship without ever thinking that I might end up getting it. And indeed, to begin with, they wrote and said, sorry, you didn't get it. And I was greatly relieved because now I can just stay home. And but then somebody dropped out.
Oh.
And they, actually, after all, you did get it.
Please,
I thought, oh, my God,
now
I've got to go. And that was really a lot of fun. I worked on semiconductor lasers there. I had not at the time heard of artificial intelligence, which is what I've ended up working on. But I met the first person I'd ever met who worked on AI, he said, and I I actually asked him if that was artificial insemination, which was all I knew at the time. And but no, of course, the MIT was a great place to do AI at the time. But mm-hmm. I have to say it had no influence on me whatsoever. I went back to the electronic engineering department and got on with my lasers.
Very nice.
But then I went back to Edinburgh to work on more lasers. And while I was there, I started working on a study of how you might navigate helicopters using cameras and how the cameras... Actually, I suppose I never thought of this, but it's sort of like a very early predecessor of what we now call SLAM, cameras are used to navigate. But these were sort of special cameras because you couldn't deal with the data from a regular camera at that time. Yeah. So it was a special camera with a kind of slit-shaped aperture. And as I was working on that, I thought, well, actually, I could do this kind of thing in a university. Maybe it would be better to do this in university than I could choose what to look at. So I moved to Edinburgh University, which was, of course, that was the same city. And they were, I looked up, in the library what had been happening in artificial intelligence, saw that Edinburgh got mentioned a lot and thought, this could be an interesting... And I ended up working with... a certain Donald Meakey, who in turn worked for Alan Turing.
Yes.
So I'm kind of intellectual grandchild of Alan Turing.
And 2 degrees of Turing.
Of Turing, exactly, sort of vertical. So he had a machine perception laboratory at the time, and he wanted somebody to come and do the vision part of what he sort of saw as his AI program. Mm-hmm. So I went there and did my doctorate and... that's how I got started on a career of doing computer vision, which I then did for the next, let me think about this, well, it's 38 years, I guess, to present day, with a few breaks to do other things like running laboratories.
And you were at Microsoft for a time, is that correct?
I was at Microsoft. So after I was at Edinburgh, did the PhD, was an academic in Edinburgh, like a lecturer for a short time. Then I went to Oxford, and I was a professor in Oxford up till... 99? And then the people who were building up the Microsoft lab, Roger Needham was the head at the time, sent me a characteristic one-line email, the kind of guy he was, saying, "Have you ever thought of working for us?" That's all it said, nothing more.
Fantastic.
And I never had thought of working for them because it never crossed my mind that Microsoft would want to do anything as crazy as computer vision. Because it really didn't work at the time, not at all, not even close. I mean... the work I did in my thesis, each image that I experimented on took 24 hours to compute. And you come back the next day, hope the computer had run without crashing all that time and sort of see what had cooked.
Right.
So that didn't seem like anything that you could, put into a product. I mean, Windows 95 or something. I mean, are you going to put... No. But then while I was in Oxford... it got steadily more practical. And by the time I was nearly finished in Oxford, then we were building programs that could react to visual stimuli in real time, not, from 24 hours to a tenth of a second or something. I mean, and the first thing that we did that did that was a very simple program. We had a robot, a rather beautiful and serious robot, with a camera in its hand that it could move around to kind of look at the world. And we wrote the simplest program that you held up a rolled up sheet of paper in front of it to move the piece of paper around.
And it
the
tracks
camera would follow you. Oh, my God, that was so exciting. Can't believe how what a moment that really, sends a shiver down your spine.
Yeah.
It's reacting to me kind of thing. You think so life created in the test tube sort of thing. I know we were a long way from artificial intelligence, but it felt like something very special. And then we got the... a special kind of computer called the transputer that was hot at the time and that allowed you to do parallel computing. So that is, getting the effort of several computers all on one task. That was another way of speeding things up. And at that point, things were beginning to look, more sophisticated, and we were able to track outlines of hands and faces and that kind of thing. And so we built the first program, I think, that allowed you to manipulate things, in virtual reality. So you can move your hand,
and the representation would move.
You move your hand and the representation inside the computer would move, and so you could use it to nudge something or pick something up. It was very, as I say, very crude by today's standards, but, you kind of saw the potential of it. And also the theory of it was very engaging. We Michael Izzard was my one of my co-workers at the time, and we wrote a book together about, you know, what we learned about how to track the outline of a hand and how to use ideas from probability in computing to make all that happen.
Wow.
So that was very exciting. So at that point, you know, and I was on sabbatical also when Roger Needham wrote this email. And so that made me quite receptive to the idea of, well, maybe I won't go back to teaching then. And so I thought, well, yeah, Microsoft, if they're willing to take the punt.
Yeah.
And I also was thinking, I think I was age, 40, let me think about this, 42 at the time. Mm. So I was thinking, well, shall I be a Don for the next 23 years and gently sliding into retirement, or is there something else that... And so the idea of going to work for Microsoft and doing something, there was one other thing as well, which was that my colleagues at the time, wonderful people in engineering who all went on to do pretty amazing things, were all starting up companies.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that common at the time. I mean, it's much more common now. But and I thought, this is impressive. They're, you know, really going to get some stuff done.
Yeah.
One of them was Hugh Durrant White, who is now the chief scientist at MOD.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just come into that job. So he was great at starting companies. And also my colleague Lionel Tarasenko, who's now head of department in engineering, the department I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very active on this kind of thing. But I thought, I'm not sure that I wanted to divert my energy into running a company, because I liked inventing things. So the idea of being in somebody else's company where they had these great channels for kind of taking your stuff and sending it out to people to use, that seemed very appealing.
Yeah.
And I was very interested at the time also in photography and Photoshop. And I remember visiting the studio of a graphic artist who was using Photoshop, and him explaining how amazing this was. And I thought, oh, you know, that's something we could do with vision. We could, you know, instead of just by hand adjusting pictures to make them more beautiful, we could actually have the computer kind of in the loop and understanding what it's looking at a bit and intervening a bit, and maybe we could do something with that. And actually that happened. So in 2004, my colleagues, Karsten Rother and Vladimir Kolmogorov, and I invented a program which we called GrabCut at the time, which was able to take the subject of a picture and kind of extract it automatically. Sometimes you didn't have to do anything at all. Other times you had to give it a bit of a nudge.
Right.
And the subject of the picture would kind of float off like a transfer. You can imagine, you know, those, and you could slide it onto something else and put it in a new context. And so that seemed very interesting. It took... You know, this is what corporations are like. It did actually take 6 more years before it emerged in a product.
Right.
But it did. It became part of Office. And it's called background removal in Office. It's still there. And it was in everything in Office, because it's easier to put in everything than just one of the things. So it's actually in Excel.
No.
I'm not quite sure how you would use it in Excel, but it was sort of easier to put it in than leave it out.
It's an option.
But in PowerPoint, it's wonderful. And I use it all the time. And
fantastic.
And Word, of course. So that was exciting. And we were also very interested in communication and kind of what technology would you need to allow you really to work from home and to be quite effective and comfortable with working from home. And the you know, Microsoft was very busy on the communications technology. NetMeeting, I think it was called at the time, was the Skype-like thing that eventually, of course, they bought Skype. That would allow you to connect with somebody else and do a meeting. And we thought, well, what would it take to make this more compelling? And of course, there are all kinds of things. I mean, there are silly, annoying, practical things like how long it takes to get connected up, and sometimes it just won't do it. And you'd like it to be seamless, but I thought that was important. But I didn't think I could really help with that. That was sort of more in the realm of the sort of systems experts that, of course, Microsoft had those too. But we did think there was this perennial problem of when you look at somebody on Skype, they're not looking at you. Because the camera's there.
The camera, the foveation problem.
So the gaze correction problem was difficult. And we thought, well, we'd try and solve that in various ways. And we ended up with various colleagues trying various different things. Some were kind of neat parlor tricks, a little bit like the kind of
shifts.
Now, what's the name of the? There's that mirror that the Victorians used to use on stage.
Yeah, to like project a sort of a ghostly shape,
exactly.
And then you have that magic trick. Yeah.
Pepper, I think it is.
Yes, Pepper's ghost. Yes,
Pepper's ghost. That one. Yes. So we tried some tricks a bit like that, and some other things to do with. Switching displays on and off very quickly, so that sometimes you could see through them and sometimes you couldn't.
Mm.
And we call that the Fokker interrupter because that's what they call the method that allows you that first allows you to shoot a machine gun out of a fighter plane. You could, if you're not careful, you shoot the
propeller
blades off
of
the propeller.
Yeah.
So it was all synchronized. So you shot always between the blades of the propeller. It's a little bit like that. Very careful timing.
Yeah.
Those were the kind of parlor trick approaches, but we also worked on using stereo vision to do it. And that was what we really spent a lot of time on, was could we get stereo vision good enough?
Yeah.
Because your stereo vision actually gives you what the psychologists called a cyclopean eye, which is an eye that is like in the middle of your head.
It's actually focused here.
Do you see out of this eye, the right eye? Do you see out of the left eye?
Mm-hmm.
No, you see effectively out of the cyclopean eye, the one in the middle.
Yeah.
So that suggests that humans are able to kind of use stereo vision to move the virtual camera around. And we thought, well, if humans can do it, perhaps we can do it with the computer. And we worked a lot on that, and we got things working, and they were perhaps still not quite good enough. Because it's very difficult to do it in a flawless way. And of course, people are very sensitive about how faces appear.
Right.
And if it weren't faces, perhaps we would have got away with the level of quality. But we were sort of striving for very high levels of quality. So that was a very interesting sort of research series. And then finally, we got onto this problem of the Kinect camera and how to automatically see the human body. So this was, in a way, harking back to the work we'd done all that time ago with the hand, back in Oxford, even with Michael Izzard, and how would you see the outline of the hand? But now scaled up to be the whole body.
Right.
And, of course, not only was it the whole body, that makes it, you know, maybe 10 or 20 times harder, but also it's got to sort of slot in to a computer that's being used to play games. So you can only use a tiny fraction of the computer to do this job. So we probably had to be, you know, 20 times better for the complexity, 20 times better for fitting into the box, maybe 400 times better overall.
Yeah.
Since we'd, of course, also it was 10 years later.
Right, yes.
So we stood a chance. And anyway, that was a very interesting story. And our technology ended up being part of the Xbox Kinect camera shipped to, you know, I believe, but I don't have the figures, I believe it was around 50 million people that bought one. So again, you know, sort of quite nice to, so we were on, you know, a few hundred million desktops with the the cutting out the background removal, and on maybe 50 million in 50 million dens with the Kinect camera. That was a very exciting time. And the solution was very exciting too. The way it worked in the end was not at all the way I had thought it worked would work. And I remember, you know, many interesting discussions where I was trying to extrapolate from what we'd done before to okay, how would that work now? How could you scale it up? And actually, Toshiba had done some very interesting work, which was kind of our starting point, and I thought we would be able to take that further. But then Jamie Shotton, who led the work, who was on my team, wanted to try a completely different way, which was much more the modern artificial intelligence approach, where he took each limb of the body and treated each bit of each limb as if it was an object.
Right.
So he'd already done some work on object recognition. Very simple stuff compared with what we do now, but it was sort of the best of its type at the time, and using decision trees instead of the neural networks, which everyone is using at the moment. And he was able to recognize with his colleagues maybe 20 different types of object, and to do it, you know, with reasonable reliability.
Yeah.
So kind of grass, road, sheep, cows, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so that was working. And so he wanted to do that, treat each bit of the body as if it was, you know, rather like the sheep and the cows and the...
Yeah, and if you can find a conglomeration of all of these things sort of in the right time, sort of fitting generally the right shape, then that's like most of a human.
Yes, and it was always supposed to be the first step. Mm-hmm. So it would kind of get you in the right frame,
right?
Everything the right way up. And then when you've done that, you'd have to refine it by having a much tighter fitting model.
Right,
like a tailor's dummy, you know, those or the life drawing dummies that you can where you can adjust all the limbs.
Yeah.
To the. So we thought of it a bit like that. In fact, some friends in Oxford had given me one of these dummies from their toy shop as a present.
Nice.
And Nick and Caroline Cooper, and I kept it in my office as an inspiration.
That's fantastic.
But you know, we ended up with the program had these two phases. There was the recognition phase, mm-hmm. the decision trees, and then the tailor's dummy to refine
right.
what you'd done. And that was the thing that worked in the end. And and as I often say, one of my main contributions was to tell Jamie that his approach with the recognition would never work. Because if you do that to some young researcher, well, you know, they're definitely going to make it work.
Exactly.
I can't claim that was my strategy. It's just, but that's what happened.
But it worked out in the end.
Yes.
And then in 2000, I believe it was 2015, you left to direct the Alan Turing Institute.
Yes,
that
and at that point I'd been director of the Microsoft Lab for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Alan Turing opportunity came up. And in fact, I was part of the sort of design team as well for the Alan Turing. So I was on the EPSRC is the government body that handles funding for research and computing, amongst other things, and they had the task of sort of designing the Alan Turing Institute. And you know, this kind of request came down from the Prime Minister himself, the famous letter with the promise of $42 million to get the thing started. Then they advertised for a director, and something must have snapped in my head, and I thought, well, why shouldn't I apply for that? So, and you know, I'd had a lot of fun in Microsoft, and it'd been a fascinating time. And I thought, well, maybe I can apply some of the insights that came from running the Microsoft lab to founding a new lab. And we had a bit of a summer program in 2016, but then the doors really swung open in the autumn of 2016. And that was when students were coming and the Turing Fellows, as we now call them, who are the kind of professors from the founding, the member universities came along.
Mm-hmm.
And we appointed research fellows who are kind of in the middle of their careers, mm-hmm. who would be based in the Turing and do research across the spread of data science, which, of course, we haven't actually said that, have we? But that's what the Turing Institute does and what it was found to do, which is to be the National Institute for Data Science. And now, actually, something very interesting has happened, which is the British government has kind of switched on to artificial intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and they decided this is a big thing. And Wendy Hall and Jerome Pazenti were commissioned to write this report on what's the potential of artificial intelligence, what do we need to do to make it happen. And then that report has been taken into the industrial strategy. So that finally, the final version came out in November. Last November, and AI is a major plank. There are four major technologies that are highlighted in the industrial strategy to say, okay, these are the things that are going to drive growth and productivity in the short and medium term. And AI is one of those four, which is an amazing
incredible
kind of advance from a piece of craziness. I have to tell you that, you know, my PhD is actually in artificial intelligence.
Mm.
I mean, that's its formal thing. And, you know, Edinburgh University was one of the few universities back in 83 when that was doing PhD. And, you know, I kept quiet about that because, you know, it was the AI winter at the time. You know, I haven't boasted about it. I'm more likely to say my PhD is in computer science. But in the last five years, I've been able to come out and and say, yes, I have a PhD in artificial intelligence. So anyway, artificial intelligence is part of the recommendation of the Hall-Pazenti report was that the Alan Turing Institute should also be the National Institute for Artificial Intelligence.
Yeah.
And so that's very new, and how that pans out is all to be explored.
Right. So already in the short existence of the Institute, you've seen almost a sea change, or what I think most other institutes would consider a sea change, having another directive added to your mission.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a big thing. You don't redefine an institute every day. And of course, you know, it's only been running for, you know, between 2 and 3 years. So that it's, yes, that's quite a big thing. And but you know, we've already got the work in data science pretty well established, and various sectors that we're going to working hard on have begun to be defined. So, for example, we're very keen to work alongside government and particularly security and GCHQ and MOD are major funders, and we've been hard at work with them, kind of defining a program. We also have another very interesting organization, which is Lloyd's Register Foundation, which is this is not Lloyd's Insurance, nor yet Lloyd's Register, which is used to be Lloyd's Register of Shipping, that is a certification business that will look at risk in large projects and certify the level of risk, which then feeds into the insurance industry. But the profit from that business goes into the Lloyd's Register Foundation. And they have a number of charitable aims which they dispense. And one of them that they're pursuing with us is data-centric engineering. So they're very interested in safety of engineering infrastructure. And so the thesis is that bringing data science into defining safe infrastructure will make a big difference.
Yeah.
And so we have Mark Girolami, who's also a professor at Imperial, is the program director for that program. And already very interesting things are happening. One of them is they've got involved in the first 3D printed footbridge.
Oh, wow.
Which is going in Amsterdam. And there's the company that's doing that has linked up with the Turing to do some of the analysis of the kind of the stresses and strains in this strange structure. Cambridge University also involved. So, you know, there are just all these opportunities to do quite new things that bring data into engineering in a very rich way.
That's so fantastic. It sounds fascinating. And you were here at the American Academy, and you were part of the organizing team for this two-day session, seminar, workshop about the future of work. So tell me about how you became involved in that and its growth and what you've gotten out of it.
Yeah, well, it's been a very interesting and surprising session. I mean, this is actually not what I spend my time doing a lot. I mean, recently I've got involved in self-driving cars and I've got back to designing algorithms again, which I kind of wasn't doing while I was busy running institutions.
Right.
And that has been fascinating. But the opportunity to think more broadly about these kinds of technologies seem very interesting. And the Royal Society had kind of set things up beautifully. They've done this machine learning report that came out nearly a year ago. And, you know, a lot of thinking has gone in from the society and its fellows, and lots of other people have come in to contribute to the implications of machine learning technology and how it plays into artificial intelligence. And so the opportunity to come and talk to a much broader set of people. I mean, we've had economists here, we've had social scientists, I mean, people who go out and do field work of various kinds in how, let's say, the gig economy is working. We've heard quite a lot about the gig economy. And actually, the discussions we've ended up having have been really very much about the shape of society.
Yeah.
And they've been very positive, actually, which also I've enjoyed, because sometimes there's a lot of breast beating goes on around discussions about AI and about the use of personal data. And of course, you know, you can do that, but I think we've done that now. Time to be more constructive and more creative and to think about, I mean, something which I was beginning to feel and which has been very much reinforced, I think, by this meeting is that there's this whole cloud of people from the diverse disciplines who've got a lot to say about how technology embeds in society and how society reacts to it and so on. But their role normally is the role of the critic. So somebody invents something, they release it on the world, maybe, you know, gig economy for taxis is one of the things that has been released on the world. And then the broader disciplines get to react to that and say, you know, what they think is good and what they think is not so good and what could be different. But I think a very interesting challenge and idea is to get those people involved much sooner as part of the kind of experimental process. I'm used to the idea of bringing designers in, and I already had begun to do that at Microsoft in the lab, hiring designers who think about the purpose of what you're doing before you actually do it.
Yeah,
it's sort of a very. I mean, you'd think that you'd think that was obvious, but I mean, it isn't actually.
Right.
It isn't actually a habit of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Some companies get it. I guess most famously, Apple gets it. I mean, they didn't go into research in a big way. But they did invest in design, and you know, that's worked very well for them.
Right,
has produced beautiful products, and that kind of thinking, and of course, what design means can also be quite broad. It's not just about physical design, or even just about human-computer interface. It's also about kind of system design. So, you know. The famous design houses like IDEO,
right.
They don't just design beautiful things. They will come into your business almost doing a little bit what management consultants do and say, well, like, what is it you're trying to achieve?
Form and
you know,
function.
How does the human, how does the human system work? What's the flow of information and of tasks? And so that kind of, you know, broad thinking about what you want to achieve and what will actually help people rather than producing a widget and say, oh, hey, okay, guys, go and play with that.
Right, yeah.
You know, I that really appeals to me.
Yeah.
But I think perhaps it could be done at even more breadth that you get sociologists and historians and economists in to think, brainstorm about technology before you start to get specific and... I don't know. You know, it'd be very interesting to try that and see how well it works. I mean... You know, the process of invention is a bit disorderly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite hard to sort of say you'll sort of have a series of steps. You know, first we consider society, then we kind of look more at the system. Because the way systems really develop is more chaotic. It's experimental. The things we're seeing now that are most successful, that are most transformative, are quite experimental. We see many versions of everybody's mobile phone system come out and, you know, sometimes changes are made and the whole population groans. Why did you wreck that? It was perfectly good.
Right.
And sometimes they get used to it and decide they like it after all. And other times it gets withdrawn. And, you know, we're all part of a big experiment.
Yeah.
And it is, as I say, necessarily disorderly.
Definitely. Excellent. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. This has been fantastic.
Great to talk to you.
Andrew Blake, Research Director at the Alan Turing Institute. It was amazing to be able to talk with him about all the changes that have gone on at the Turing Institute, their recent expansion, but then also just like hearing about his work in computer vision and just have him sort of nonchalantly talk about doing all these super fundamental things was a real treat.
Yeah, no, he's been a mainstay of the UK's computer vision, MLAI, whatever community for a number of years, and always very friendly, and someone that I've known for a long time. In fact, he lives around the corner from me now in Cambridge, and so I get to see him quite regularly, but it's always great to hear from him and his insights, and the different places have been Oxford, Microsoft Research, and now the Alan Turing Institute.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's it for us this week on Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
Tune in next episode.